I'm Jason Michael Perry, the man with three first names, and this is Thoughts on Tech and Things. My consulting firm works with a lot of businesses on AI and technology. One of those clients was an investor pitch about a year and a half ago, and after the meeting, an investor pulled us aside and said, no more clickable prototypes. With AI tools that can help you build applications like Lovable, Claude Code, OpenAI Codex, the goalposts have moved. His expectation was that you walk in with a working MVP, a minimal viable product from day one. For founders, the goalposts have moved. What it takes to raise money in a world where one person can vibe code a platform in a week is a completely different game. To talk about this, I took the Amtrak to WHYY Studios in Philly to sit down with Chris Wink, co-founder and CEO of Technically. We met up with Chris a day before Philly Tech Week kicked off, and we got into how AI is impacting founders and the workers and the cities that are trying to build ecosystems around them. Let's get into this conversation, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Invested in AI but not seeing results? You're not alone. Perry Labs helps organizations figure out what's working and what's next. Start with our AI assessment at perrylabs.io.
The path to growth shouldn't stop at the border. The World Trade Center Institute provides the connections, knowledge, and global network Maryland's most ambitious leaders need to scale. From executive development to international trade, we help our region's businesses thrive on the world stage. Start your global journey at WTCI.org. I'm in Philly this week recording out of WHYY for Philly Tech Week, and I'm here to speak at the Technically Builders Conference. In between hunting down the best Philly cheesesteaks in the city, I'm here joined with Chris Wink. Chris is the co-founder and CEO of Technically, a news organization that's been covering tech and startup ecosystems across the Mid-Atlantic for 15 plus years and recently expanded into Louisiana. If you live anywhere from D.C. up to Pennsylvania or down in the Gulf, if you're not already a regular reader, the site and the newsletter are very much worth your time. Chris also just published his first kid's book, Philly ABCs. Chris, welcome to Thoughts on Tech and Things.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I read a piece that you published a few weeks back, Finding the Signal in AI's Noise, and I'll put this in the show notes later on. And it reminded me of a video on YouTube called Humans Need Not Apply. Now, the specific thing in this video is, this video is from 2014, so 12 years ago or so now. But the part that reminded me of your piece was the horse analogy. Now, bear with me for a second here. Before the Model T, we hit the biggest population of horses. That was the peak. Then after the Model T, the horse population today is a tiny fraction of what it was at that period. And that's because horses essentially became unemployable. Technology usurped them and our needs changed. In your article, you touch on this exact nerve that the signal to noise of AI right now is at an all-time high, and that one side believes that this is going to destroy all the jobs, all work, and everything as we know it. Another side is saying it's going to open the door to more jobs. It's going to provide more growth, more opportunities. And after writing this piece, did you find yourself feeling one way or the other? Did you land somewhere?
I am somewhere, as I so often get, at least temporarily. By 17 plus years of technology reporting, entrepreneurship, economic, it's full of people making predictions. And as a journalist, I have always found this challenging because I have been spoken to very confidently on lots of things that were true and lots of things that proved untrue. And so I found that confidence is a very poor predictor of whether someone is accurate or not. And so pretty quickly, I learned to discount the volume or the velocity that anyone has ever told me anything, especially around future casting. So in this moment, we've covered artificial intelligence, machine learning, this category we described, for a long time. But of course, it's a little bit different right now. And so I found myself having to go back to some basics. So here's where I am as a journalist and as an organizer, as a leader of an organization trying to make my own bets. One of the foundational difficulties of any prediction is the timeline. It's a lot easier to predict something could happen than it is to predict when that could happen. And so those are two different things. This thing could be true. This thing will be true soon. And that is the moment we're in right now, is mixing those thing up. In the research communities, in and around computer science, I think it's worth, as I use that piece to describe, to actually not think of this as a spectrum of will it be good or will it be bad, but to kind of draw more like a 2x2 quadrant, which is, do you think it'll be net good for more people or net bad for more people? and to describe, do we think this technology is different than all of the ones in the past or similar to ones in the past?
In your piece, that there's a Richter scale that I guess shows the technology Richter scale that says the impact of technology. That sounds somewhat similar to that. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and that's Nate Silver's use of the Richter scale metaphor, because his point was the microwave did matter, but it mattered differently than credit cards, which mattered differently than electricity, which mattered differently than the internet. Those all had meaningful impacts. In our own reporting, 3D printing, we were around long enough that we were in the epicenter of 3D printing in the early 2010s in Brooklyn. And I can remember doing those stories of 3D printing will be everywhere. There will be a 3D printer on everyone's counter, like microwaves were in everyone's counter. That didn't prove true on the timescale we're on right now, at least. But it did have a real impact. The technology wasn't bogus. It ended up just having more industrial applications. So that was like, that's a good use case for me, where those, I can look back at interviews I did, at notes I did, at headlines we published. The core technology prediction was true. It did advance in some of the ways we were told, but it didn't play out in the consumer applications that people expected. You just didn't want to make your own fork. And that is instructive. So the Richter scale gives you a kind of, well, what scale are we operating on? You know, is it a 10 like fire? Is it an 8 or 9 like electricity? Is it a 7 or 8 that some stage of the internet might be described as, or some mobile applications? Meaningful, really did have worked or disruption, but we've been through that before. So to come back to your core question, one of the, I think, the most interesting tensions right now in AI criticism is you have a kind of doomer camp that is best known, which is, you know, this technology will only end one way, and that's humanity's destruction. But you understand how that still assumes the technologies are different than all others of the past. So often it's talked about that the doomers and the biggest AI hypers share a lot in common. They both think this technology, this class of technologies, is different than all others before us. But there's another camp of criticisms that now the research community calls themselves the current harms community, in which they will talk about, we think that whole notion is bogus, that this class of technologies is more similar to other past technologies, and focusing on that is distracting. We should just focus on the very real day-to-day impacts that we'll see. We'll see some worker displacement. So to bring back to your actual question, where am I in that quadrant? I, at present, still believe that more of us aim to do good than bad, and that I believe this class of technologies looks more like other big, meaningful platforms we've seen before. And so I think we should be focusing a lot more on the people deploying the technologies than the technology themselves.
It's interesting that, you know, of course, hindsight is 2020, as we always say. Looking today at social media, Meta, Facebook just recently lost a big suit because of the many things that they've been known to do. It's weird to think of the internet and look at where we are now and think of that progression. Just in terms of jobs, things like a travel agent, these are jobs that for the most part no longer exist. But in 1997 and 1998, it was hard to imagine that a job like social media manager or that a digital media manager of some sort would exist. These are things that we couldn't imagine. And so here we are at the AOL days of AI, looking at this technology just like we did at the internet, imagining what a future is going to look like. And of course, you know, it's all going to make sense when you look at this, you know, 20, 50 years from now, but it still feels different. I'm a software engineer, and I write software. A lot of the engineers that I work with are using tools like OpenAI's Codex or Claude Code, and instead of writing code, they are orchestrating AI. They are AI orchestrators. And this is a big change because suddenly things are different, right? There was a recent report that said that physicians in emergency room, that using OpenAI's tools, OpenAI model, that the model was 67% accurate compared to doctors being 50-55% in terms of the accuracy. So we're seeing this technology come into places that the internet or technology before didn't. And so, again, does this feel different to you as well?
Yes. To answer your question, yes. It always feels different because we are different people each time we confront a technology, because we're at a different stage of our lives and our careers and our worlds. So we never meet. No one has ever met a new platform technology the second time because they were different people, even if they did meet the next one. a foundation of technically is reporting, my worldview is Kranzberg's law, technology is neither good nor bad nor neutral. Increasingly, my journalistic focus is I think at times our focus on the technology is distracting, that there is no reason the hammer emoji conveys building to you when it doesn't as much convey murder weapon to you. There's no reason other than oodles of culture. For thousands of years, we've kind of like packed on culture to that object, that tool, and it symbolizes something to us. By which I mean, we decide the ultimate fate of what we'll do with these tools. This is why social media, social networking had profound good. You did handed over new plants to neighbors and met new friends and kept up with old ones. And it sowed the fall of both tyrants and democratically elected officials. Like, all of those things are true because the technology is in point. The people using the technology are the point. So I find the most challenging questions are like, who is wielding the technologies of this era?
I guess it's Thor's hammer, whoever has the power.
Yes, right? Like, comics are fables of our era for a reason. It does tell the right story. So I think if we focus on, is AI bad, that I think is distracting. I don't think that matters at all. I think AI is agnostic. I think AI means nothing. I think what we do with the tools are the case. There is a line of literature that would push me, but that's where I am at the moment.
Which is very interesting time right now because there is an amazing piece on Sam Altman, the man behind the technology, at least for OpenAI. And we've heard a lot about Anthropic as well. And there are increasingly concerns about the people who are bringing this technology, the potential bias that can happen, you know, with folks like Elon Musk and Grok. And so it does bring up that question, like, who are the people that are helping to bring this to market?
I did a talk at a New Mexico conference about a month ago. And one thing that was just like interesting is in this audience, I'm of course simplifying, but it shows up a little bit in the data too. The older audience members were more optimistic about this class of technologies, and the youngest in the audience were the most pessimistic. And the questions tracked that. And we have a little bit of polling data that kind of gets at that a bit. It's not quite that, but at least directionally. So I think there are things that are different. You know, each generation responds and sees what came before them differently. Wide-eyed millennials got a lot of social media optimism wrong. And their younger brothers, sisters, cousins in Gen Z and look at that as foolhardy. And are coming with a kind of skepticism that my generation just simply did not to social media. So I like that. I am glad that more of us have awoken to the tension there of the people. In that conference in New Mexico, when I gave my talk around these are tools, what we do with the tools are ultimately our decision, the most challenging question I got from probably one of the younger people in the audience was, where do you get any confidence or optimism whatsoever that our generation of leaders will do anything noble or good with these tools? And I'll be honest with you, Jason, that for me is a much harder, more challenging line of questioning that I do listen to and where I'm most sympathetic to the critics. As long as I offer that, like, I'm a little less interested in the core technologies, flaws or strengths than I am the who's wielding them. A nuclear weapon in different people's hands mean different things.
It's interesting. The Verge has also did a lot of reporting about this exact thing, specifically that Gen Z's viewpoints on technology and the technology industry. I mean, they don't like the tech industry. They don't like the tech CEOs. They have a very different feeling relationship than I think that we do, where maybe you idolize the Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and the people who founded this industry, but suddenly tech founders see more like oil barons of the day today. It's the sentiment has changed a lot.
Technology is often described as a kind of magic. We don't have enough people scrutinizing the magicians. And I like to believe that we're getting better at that now. I like to believe that technically over our history did that at times, but I can reflect on when we were of the era or not. This question of whether this time is different, I wrestle with a lot. We have a long history of moments when, oh, we'll run out of food. Oh, wait, we innovated our way out of it and we've made advanced fertilizers and we were able to feed everyone. Like, we have lots of those stories, and a lot of us know these stories. But I also know that's like a deeply discomforting thing to someone younger than I am, that don't worry, we'll figure it out. I can't look in good faith at that and say that's an honest thing to say to my children. So I don't know what else to do other than to say I want smarter residents, voters, leaders engaging with these issues. And I don't think blind faith that it's magic is the right move. I think understanding at best as we can what these tools are matters. And I think the criticism that will slow down this is as necessary as anything, because that's how culture making happens.
So I want to move on to something a little different. You sit in a unique seat. You're talking to the economic developers, the workforce development agencies and organizations, but you're also talking to the ecosystem builders, the founders, the entrepreneurs, and the folks who make up these different ecosystems and the services that are provided in 8-9 states, Wilmington, Baton Rouge, all these different cities. And I'm curious the commonalities of how these different groups are responding to AI, how they're approaching AI, especially workforce development and economic development.
I am sympathetic to a lot of people that if you think real critically and specifically about what folks are having to do, if they are sitting in a state workforce board, or they're at a regional nonprofit, or they're leader of a company that has to make hiring decisions or projections on what kind of staffing roles they'll have, it's a messy thing. You need to make bets, but the incentives are different. So yeah, I've done some reporting that I pulled the high priority jobs, which is a list that most U.S. states in most of the country generate annually. And typically it's tied toward workforce funding. So if I'm at a state workforce board, somewhere there's a meeting and somewhere there's a set of both data analyses and people who talk do field work, and they come together and make a list of these are the jobs we think are going to grow most in our state. And we're going to usually in some form or not tie state or even federal block grant dollars down to the individual nonprofits that might produce the programs, the schools, even curriculum, depending on how unified the strategy is. And so that's where a lot of the mechanics of preparing a workforce happen. It's very gummed up, doesn't move fast, somewhat by design. But still, I thought it was worth looking at a 2019 pre-mainstream LLM era and today. And there's been very little change in most states. So in most states, effectively, the strategy, you could have Xeroxed the one from 2019 and it will look pretty similar. And I did a couple off-the-record interviews with leaders that were like, what do you want us to do? We got no idea what's happening. The past was the best predictor of the future for us.
My son's graduating from high school, so he's starting at Wash U in the fall. And
congrats.
We did a tour of the campus, and walking through the campus, the feelings from computer science students or technical students or folks who are normally going to engineering type degrees, you could see the fear on their face of whether or not all of this time that workforce development agencies and organizations have focused on STEM jobs and STEAM, and this is the product of that. And now, what does this mean? Does it matter? Where does this put us? And that has to be a hard space. All of this work to help produce leaders and the workforce of the future that we thought we needed. And just like that, that dial changes. And college kids, my daughter, who's in college right now, she's a sophomore, she's asking the question, like, what's a safe career choice? What's a safe degree to go, you know, to get in a time where there's a lot of this disruption, which I think goes back to your comments about Gen Z. It's rough.
I think so many of the fights we have with our neighbors, our friends, our family online is about time scale. I struggle with the doomer camp because I understand the math. If you read any of the books or the papers or the X threads, I can follow the thinking about how we end up in AI dystopian outlook. I meaningfully struggle with the class of technologies we have now getting there. But I understand the criticism that you have to prepare before. And I also balance your daughter or my kids or someone who's making a career choice right now that I have to operate in a different time scale. And these are very hard balances. And so I think we almost have to have different conversations and do a better job of talking about it. Are we talking about how this might play out over years longer? Or are we talking about people's decisions now? And those are different. They relate, but they're different conversations. And I bring different research into that conversation.
Are you seeing differences? I'm from New Orleans, and your move into Louisiana and the Gulf South is relatively new. But I would imagine New Orleans being a very tourism-based city, maybe there's a little bit of safety that they have from the encroachment of AI or a different take that they may have in terms of workforce development. Do you see a lot of differences between the different regions, the different states, the different cities that you work with? Or is there one or two that you're like, they haven't figured out?
It's certainly not that. But we are in an interesting moment where we have across countries and across regions and states, wide variety in approval of the technology and adoption of the technology. So this is not a single story. One of the big interesting threads that our dear friends at Pew Research is following closely, and they did their last numbers in the fall that I think are super interesting, comparing across countries approval or optimism might be the phrase they use toward a class of technologies we call artificial intelligence. And the people in countries as varied as South Korea, Nigeria, and India are considerably more optimistic. I can't say optimistic because there's lots of pessimism still there too, but are much more open to the good than the US, the UK, and Brazil. So we have real variation across countries in our world, and in states we see it in adoption is really far flung. We did a little reporting at Technically, and you can pull the I think Census has a decent number of by state, both businesses, which is the more prominent number, but also resident adoption. Man, it's a cliche, but I wouldn't know what to do with my kids other than to say, I want you to understand the class of technologies emerging right now at all times. I want you to play with them. You can develop your own opinions about them. You can develop your own thoughts of them. You can run far away from them because you could say, I think experiences are going to thrive. I think hospitality and art is going to thrive because people will look for real. That makes total sense to me. And if you want to go more into a career in the arts, that makes sense. Or you could say, I want to understand how the machines work and work in that and work in those fields too. As long as we're building on better information about that work, I'm optimistic collectively we can make good choices. Inside the system, it's noisy along the way.
So founders are finding themselves in also an unusual situation. I have a client that we had a chance to sit down with their lead investor. And their lead investor said that maybe, you know, 3-4 years ago, coming to them for applications of software with clickable prototypes and examples of software was fine. But now the expectation is you're using AI and tools to get to the point that you have maybe MVP, a minimal viable product, or something that has a little bit more meat on the bones. And I like to say this, that when I think about AI and AI adoption, that AI is a performance-enhancing drug. It's something that no matter how good you are, everyone else around you is taking this drug, and they are going to be able to move at a speed that you can't without it. And suddenly, founders and ecosystem builders that are out there, they have to take this drug, or they have to be prepared to compete with other companies that are doing this. You know, in some ways, this means that the goalposts that maybe, you know, when you started Technically that you were dealing with have moved substantially, you know, today for entrepreneurs who are trying to fund or start a new business. I'm curious what your take is or your thoughts on that.
I did a piece. I got really interested in, was the internet better for entrepreneurs, for new firm creation or incumbents? Really super sounding question. But I spoke to a few folks, pulled some research, and the simplest narrative I got out of it was for a time, and then as incumbents caught up to the class of technology, what mostly the American economy has done over the last 50 years has more often consolidated than not. So the internet broke open a window, and we got a new class of winners. Many of them are companies we know, but there's a whole other generation of small and mid-sized firms that got little market niches in. But then we watched over time as that technology, the class of technology we call the internet, as all those tools platformed on, a bunch of incumbents caught up. An open question is, what will AI look like? in the one of the, I think I'm going to forget the source that we pull from for some reporting we do it technically, but right now we see the largest firms deploying AI the fastest, which tends to be what we see with a new technology. Even if you tease about a big corporation, they tend to have some staff somewhere in a back room that can at least play with it. So large firms do it, and the smallest firms are doing it. It's the middle-sized firms that are the slowest to adopt AI tools right now. So my point in saying that is the entrepreneurial journey is widespread. I think you're right, performance enhancing. I might even say it accelerates you, but you can still go down the wrong direction, right? Like going faster the wrong way doesn't get you to the destination in the most effective means possible. So I still would want to say to entrepreneurs, with clarity, you can going slow is smooth, smooth is fast, but you have to know where you want to go.
We're increasingly hearing the words AI native, companies that are AI native that use this stuff to the core or to their soul. I say at Perry Labs that we treat AI like Tabasco sauce. We put it on everything. Sam Altman has said that he imagines that we may have a one-person billion-dollar company in the next 5 to 10 years, someone who's orchestrating AI tools. And that says just how much is possible with a founder today versus what was possible before. So, you know, the space is changing. But also, just like you said, it's easier for smaller businesses to be nimble, to adopt this technology. And I think it's more transformative where larger companies have to deal with all of the change management to move an organization, a team. You know, I wonder if this is an opportunity for us to really embrace, going back to the workforce development groups, embracing entrepreneurship, if that's the future, if this is more around people, smaller businesses, smaller teams being able to do things that they couldn't do before.
I hope. I am maybe one of the more radical takes I think is developing inside of me after all this reporting is I think we need more precise terms around entrepreneurship. And so for us at Technically, increasingly, we think that entrepreneurship should be defined by new firm creation, new people getting new swings. And that should be consistent with a lot of interest in the sciences and technology is we want more at-bats for more people. And it can back into some mission work that I care about, but I think it's also just good, sound economic theory. And I find a lot of incumbents and entrenched interests like to wear the cape of entrepreneurship because it polls well and it sounds good, and they kind of mix it up with general small business ideology, which isn't quite right because they are different things. I worry that a lot of our increasingly entrenched economy doesn't really want a lot of new at-bats, don't want really a lot of new winners. And so I want us to scrutinize who will win. And I think the narrative that AI is good for more individuals is a comforting one. And that might be true. And some of the data, I'm watching it closely. The small firms are doing it. The most recent piece I did for Technically that is rattling in my head is the narrative we have about the K-shaped economy more generally. You know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and the middle get squeezed. We see a version of that happening in entrepreneurship too. That we are, it is true, we've seen a real explosion of high-growth companies. Lots of regions around the country have put relatively good programs and resources and capital readiness programs, and we do scale companies fast. They're there. But the fastest-growing category of new firm creation is firms that don't employ anyone. Those people are disproportionately likely to live in poverty. They'd be richer off if they just got a wage. And then the middle, those firms that are between 5 and 50 employees, in the mid-1990s, $1 in $10 of U.S. GDP went to those mid-sized firms. That's halved since. So whether AI will accelerate this bifurcation, that, yeah, you'll have some small, really big winners and a lot of individuals that would have had wages in the past but have now been pushed off corporate roles and are essentially doing versions of gig work. What used to be the Uber driver could be a kind of project manager type role a decade from now, and it's living in precarious nature. That worries me if we call that entrepreneurship, not because I don't want to respect it, but because I think we could blanket hollowing out of our economy and put pressure on people in uncomfortable ways.
So last question. This week is Philly Tech Week and your own Builders Conference, which I'm looking forward to. By the time this podcast episode airs, the conference would have passed. However, for those folks who are not going to make it this year, I'm hoping you can give us an idea of what we can expect. And also, is there anything that technically has on the radar for maybe next year or events, activities, or things that you just want to make sure that we're aware of that we should have on the map?
For most my entire journalism career, this beat that I've focused on and care so much about around commercializing science, technology, entrepreneurship, I have recognized now that it was always seen as a kind of fringe issue, this other kind of category, the tech community over there. And I increasingly believe that we got it all wrong, and we should have all along been saying, this is where an economy starts, and everything else follows on it. This is where you care about small business growth. It starts first with the breakthrough innovation that creates economic activity. You care about solving people's problems. It starts with the lab that solves some core problem in a lab and then commercializes it after. So I think of this work of entrepreneurial ecosystem building, technology and sciences and innovation is about creating opportunity and debating who gets to benefit from that economic activity. I think it's the start of everything. And so we technically report on these change makers in the communities we serve. This conference we organize at the Technically Builders Conference, small, fewer than 500 people, but it's gathering those who do that work. And we, with our specialty, focus on how we tell stories about it. So for the entrepreneurs and the economic developers around the country, I want them to recognize their work are not the side issue. It is how we steer our economy to benefit more people and thrive dynamically. And I think the fight of our era will be how we tell that story. We are communicating. Why should we focus on entrepreneurship rather than established interests? I don't think anyone's coming for us. I think we have to be out in our communities saying, this is not a fringe issue. This is how we make the community we want for the future.
Chris, thank you for your time. Chris is the co-founder and CEO of Technically and author of a new book, new kids book, Philly ABCs.
Thanks, Jason.
One more thing before you go. Google rolled out its new AI-powered search at its Google I.O. event, and within days, people figured out that if you just type the word disregard into Google, the AI reads it as a system instruction, and it replies, understood, message disregarded, and no longer will return any results. Some have discovered that words like ignore or stop do the same thing. So the biggest search engine on Earth, broken by the most basic prompt injection trick in the book, what could possibly go wrong? All right, folks, that's Thoughts on Tech and Things for the week. Let me know your thoughts by leaving me a message in the WYPR app, calling 410-735-1616, or find me at jasonandperry.com. Thanks to the team at WYPR, our producer, Shania Mapson. Big thanks to WHYY in Philly for letting us use their studios, and Diana Martinez for being this week's audio engineer, and Perry Labs Head of Operations and Marketing, Myrna Martinez. New episodes drop every other week. I'm Jason Michael Perry. This is Thoughts on Tech and Things, and I'll see you next time.